Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alcock, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Becca Staley. You, Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming right up on 5 o'clock. Coming up next is going to be your evening news after these short messages.
I used to live in the darkness, dressing black, act so heartless, but now I see the colors are everything.
The Family Preservation Project helped me learn to parent, connect with my family and community, and continue my relationship with my children from prison.
The Family Preservation Project helped me grow as a person, move on with my life, and gave me the skills to break the cycle of addiction and criminal activity. Hear why the Oregon Legislature should fund the Family Preservation Project in this 2020 legislative session. Join us on Prison Pipeline January 27th at 6:30 p.m.
I look to the skies, found a rainbow, rainbow baby, trust me, I know. Life is scary, but just put those colors on, girl. Come and play along with me tonight.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Vancouver Variety Market, Saturday, February 1st, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Minnehaha Grange in Vancouver, Washington. Vancouver Variety Market is an indoor marketplace held twice a month on every first and third Saturday, featuring a wide variety of vendors offering new and used merchandise, household goods, vintage pieces, antiques, handcrafted works of art, pop culture collectibles, and more. Again, that's Vancouver Variety Market on Saturday, February 1st from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Minnehaha Grange, 4905 Northeast St. John's Road in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Representative Rashida Tlaib visits Portland.
The trial of Jeremy Christian is set to begin tomorrow.
And the results of the Lentz renter survey are announced, and tenants face significant housing insecurity.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News from Monday, January 27th, 2020. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib paid a visit to Jefferson High School on Saturday, speaking at a public forum hosted by Representative Earl Blumenauer. Addressing Portland's housing crisis, Tlaib was adamant about the Rose City rejecting spending public dollars on a new sports stadium. The Portland Diamond Project has its eye on some riverfront expanse known as Terminal 2, a desolate 45-acre property owned by the Port of Portland for a 32,000-seat Major League Baseball stadium. Renowned as both a Democratic socialist and one of the first two Muslim women ever elected to Congress, Tlaib slammed the idea, as many Portlanders face concerns about affordable housing and rising rents. Calling the proposal a, quote, terrible, really bad idea, Tlaib added, quote, mayors come and go, city council members come and go, but neighborhoods don't go anywhere. Blumenauer contributed his calls to make Section 8 housing vouchers an entitlement akin to food stamps, as well as intentions to create a renter's tax credit and to remove the caps on building public housing known as the Faircloth Amendment. Saturday's town hall drew hundreds of participants, with Tlaib receiving fervid support for her stance on affordable housing, a further extension of her vision for anti-poverty programs.
Jeremy Christian, the man charged with fatally stabbing two men on a Portland MAX train, begins his trial proceedings tomorrow. A jury of 12 men and women has been seated, called by Multnomah County Judge Cheryl Albrecht, to serve through the expected month-long trial. Three felony charges have been dismissed as prosecutors are focusing on the more serious charges of first-degree murder and attempted murder. 37-year-old Christian is charged with stabbing three men on the MAX light rail system on May 17th of 2017, killing two. He was confronted by the three men during a racist rant aboard the train. Taliza Namakai Meshe and Ricky Best died from the attack, while Micah Fletcher sustained wounds to his neck. Christian has pleaded not guilty to the charges of murder and attempted murder by reason of mental disease or defect, but has never denied stabbing the three men. Prosecutors are expected to argue his intent by presenting evidence from the night prior, where Christian was observed shouting racist insults at a black woman on another train and threatening to stab her.
On Saturday, the results of a summertime survey of renters in the Lentz neighborhood were announced. It found that while most households are stable, in that the tenants have not moved recently, they are worried and vulnerable. Limited budgets and possible rent increases adds to mental and physical health stress on renters, and many of the households included in the survey are especially vulnerable due to age, disability, or medical condition. The group Southeast Portland Renters in Action worked with Portland State University to collect information on renters and their concerns. At the forum where the results were announced, attendees also talked about possible solutions. KBOO's S.J. Oxendine went to the unveiling of the survey and brings us this report.
We have the main speaker, Dr. Lisa Bates from the School of Urban Studies. I believe, Professor, that most people will be most interested in what you have to say. So can you give our listeners the highlighted and abbreviated version of your talk today?
Sure. So our research team was led by folks from the Southeast Renters in Action group, Lentz community members who wanted to create a survey to find out what was happening for people in this community who live here and are experiencing challenges that aren't really seen or understood by policymakers. So PSU supported them to create this survey and implement a door-to-door survey. We spoke to a bit over 100 households and asked them about their experiences, the challenges they face, and some of their worries for the future. What we found is that over half of the renters that we talked about have pretty significant vulnerabilities in terms of things that would make them vulnerable to housing stressors or even displacement.
Please be a little bit more specific. Yeah. About what you mean by vulnerabilities and stressors.
Yeah, so these are folks who are older and have a fixed income. About half have either a physical disability or consider themselves to be medically fragile. There are also about a quarter to a third who speak English only as a second language, have immigration documentation issues, or have other challenges with their rental history, credit history, or legal background that would make it hard for them to find housing if they needed to. So for most of the folks in the survey, they are experiencing problems with housing affordability. Even though we found that a lot of people are pretty stable in terms of not having to move very much, but they are really increasingly worried about what might happen to them in the future. People are
worried about rental increases, worried about the stability of the company that rents for them. Yeah. What kind of worries?
So people are worried about things like if they're already, about 40% of people are already cutting out necessities in order to pay for their rent. So if their rent goes up, what would they do? People are worried about conflicts they have with their landlords or their landlords evicting them. And they know that if they had to move in the next month, so one of our questions was, if you had to move in the next month, what would you do? Three quarters of people are really worried about finding a place that they could afford, and three quarters of people say they wouldn't be able to afford the moving costs themselves. And with also pretty significant numbers of people saying that they would have a problem even looking for a home. About 50% of the people said they would, just the search itself would be a challenge and a barrier for them. So, and I think even more impactful is to know that half of the folks who answered the survey are already experiencing physical health and mental health challenges that they attribute to the stress of their housing situation. Even though they are currently housed, the stress of thinking about the kinds of possible things that will happen in the future is affecting their health.
So the information that you collect, who is it going to, and what will they do with it?
It's going to this group right here, Southeast Runners in Action, and the community folks who created, you know, the idea for the survey. So who will decide what to do with it are people who are in this room at this forum and other tenants who want to ask more questions and generate their own solutions. I think our team very much believes that the people who are experiencing an issue have, they know what's going on and they know what they want to do about it. And so we want to support the development of those ideas because we need more creative and new transformative ideas to really solve these problems.
All right, now we're going to hear Joanne Lucchini read in what policy changes have been proposed.
So these are some of the changes in housing policies and practices that our little table talked about. We suggested solid rent control like that in Berkeley and New York City. We suggested better screening of landlords and property managers, and that's to exact accountability because there's too much of an attitude that if you're poor and you're in low-income housing, then you're lucky you get what you get. So they would like to see not the landlords not also watch themselves for bullying of tenants, but also look for tenant-on-tenant bullying and making sure that the properties where people live in are clean and safe and everything else. It was recognized that mixed neighborhoods are the ones that are the healthiest and strongest. And by mixed, we're talking about mixed ages, mixed ethnicity and race, mixed income, and the idea that there should be integration, not segregation. But while increasing the supply of mixed housing, we also wanted people to realize that you also had to provide the necessary infrastructure and the services and the public transit. So it really does nothing to say you have mixed housing if there's no grocery store and there's no way to get to the grocery store.
This is S.J. Oxendine reporting for KBOO.
An open seat on the Multnomah County Circuit Court has four attorneys running for what will be a rare contested campaign. Judge Gregory F. Silver, who was appointed by Governor John Kitzhaber in 2013, announced his plans for retirement after the May primary election and then alerted other judges that he will not be seeking re-election. Adrian L. Brown, an assistant U.S. attorney in Oregon for 12 years, announced her candidacy on Monday. Brown serves as the office's civil rights coordinator and has handled cases involving the state's mental health system, police practices, and disability access. The other three who have filed to run for the seat are Portland criminal defense lawyer Ernest Warren Jr., civil attorney Rima Grandauer, and lastly, Sonia Maltabano, also a civil lawyer. The open seat is a relative rarity since judicial races in Oregon usually involve a governor-appointed incumbent. Nearly all sitting judges have run unopposed for re-election, with retirements planned so the governor may pick their successors.
Two Oregon Democrats are calling for the state to step up its enforcement of housing discrimination laws. Oregon Labor Commissioner Val Hoyle and Senator Shamia Fagan announced Thursday that they will push to require heavier enforcement of fair housing laws throughout the state. A Senate bill proposal is calling for the allocation of nearly $300,000 directed towards an investigative legal staff to follow through with complaints about housing discrimination, as well as towards educating landlords on fair housing laws. Hopes are the bill would solidify a deal between Oregon and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Hoyle has criticized the current system, claiming Oregon residents must go through a, quote, backlogged federal process to reconcile reports of housing discrimination, as cases must go through federal agencies first before being directly addressed by state labor bureaus. Hoyle and Fagan were prompted to propose the bill as recent local surveys found more than one in four Portland renters were discriminated against because of their race, country of origin, or source of income. If the new proposal becomes law, federal dollars for cases of housing violations will cover 90% of the costs after the state allocates one-time funds. Hoyle told reporters on Thursday, quote, "Our focus is to make sure that when these cases happen, there is someone who's going to investigate it, so we can have justice for victims who have been robbed.
Despite recent outbreaks of vaping-related injuries and deaths, recent studies are showing that Oregonians may be smoking less, but vaping more. In hopes of addressing rising vaping statistics with state action, the Vaping Public Health Work Group will begin meetings on Tuesday in Salem to confront the epidemic. Governor Kate Brown announced the membership of the group on Monday, which includes state legislators, representatives, pulmonologists, and public health experts. Lillian Shirley, director of the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division, warns against a haze of misinformation that obscures the danger vaping poses to health. She urges users to stop vaping immediately. Shirley points to claims made by the industry suggesting that e-cigarettes are a safe way to quit smoking. In actuality, they are far more likely to be used by youth to begin nicotine use. Recent surveys show that 1 in 4 Oregon high school juniors regularly vape nicotine. That's up 80% since 2017. These reports also show youth introduced to vaping are 3 times more likely to begin smoking cigarettes. Health officials also maintain that recent outbreaks of vape-related illness have been largely blamed on cannabis products and flavored additives. Governor Brown commented, quote, "After years of lax federal regulation, there is no way to ensure the safety of many vaping products that are now on the market."
Helping Hands Reentry Outreach Centers is raising money to help turn Wapato Jail into transitional housing for people who are homeless. Here to tell us more is KBOO's Melissa Hood. Welcome, Melissa.
Thanks. The Helping Hands Reentry Outreach Center, a nonprofit organization, works with the homeless in Clatsop, Tillamook, Yamhill, and Lincoln counties and plans to run the Wapato facility. Now, thanks to donations, Portland's never-used jail is one step closer to becoming the Bybee Lakes Hope Center. Organizers were hoping to raise $2.5 million in the next year to aid the project. They have already raised that amount in just 3 weeks. The facility can hold an estimated 250 people and will offer connections to recovery addiction services, job training programs, and provide transportation to and from downtown programs. A public tour of the facility was hosted on Saturday in celebration of reaching the financial milestone. About 1,000 people showed up for the tour. Organizers hope to raise another $4 million over the next 2 years, which will help fund renovations for the building and at least the first year of operating costs.
As you've likely heard by now, former NBA superstar Kobe Bryant was killed Sunday morning in a helicopter crash near Calabasas, California. Bryant was a celebrated athlete who played his entire 20-year career in the NBA with the Los Angeles Lakers and won many awards and championships with that team. He was 41 years old. Including Bryant, there were 9 people on board the helicopter. All 9 passengers were killed when it crashed. Among the other passengers included Bryant's 13-year-old daughter Gianna, along with the pilot, Era Zabayan, and the rest of the crash victims, who included girls basketball coach Christina Mauser, Sarah Chester and her daughter Peyton Chester, and college baseball coach John Altobelli, his daughter Alyssa Altobelli, and his wife Carrie. Authorities have yet to pinpoint the cause of the crash, but witnesses and air traffic controllers noted that there was a dense blanket of morning fog in the area at the time of the accident.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement is accused of brutal treatment in a Washington State traffic stop. On Friday, protesters lined up outside an immigrant holding station in Ferndale, Washington, where they believe the man brutally handled by ICE was being held. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents are being accused of brutally taking a Washington man into custody. A farm worker, who only wants to be identified by his first name, Medardo, was in the car with his wife and children when ICE pulled him over in Everson. According to his wife, agents aggressively asked Medardo to open his door, hurling racial slurs at him, but he refused. The agents called for backup, and when the man still refused their orders, they smashed his window and dragged him from the car. Australia Hernandez-Cosby is a local community organizer with the immigrant farm workers' rights group Community to Community Development.
Father exercises right to say, you know, hey, y'all have a warrant signed by a judge. And they're like, no, we don't. We're above the law. That was like really prominent quotes there that they said that they were above the law.
ICE says Medardo has been voluntarily returned to Mexico on 3 separate occasions, although it did not say he had a criminal record besides entering the country illegally. The agency added that breaking the car window is routine law enforcement work when someone refuses to comply with the law. Medardo is in custody at the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma. Hernandez-Cosby says she's heard reports of escalating tactics from ICE across the state, such as forced entry into cars and houses. However, she says this case has hit close to home.
He works in our community. He lives here with his children. They're part of the community. They help support our community with agriculture, and we just don't need that. We don't need family members like this taken. These shouldn't be priority for ICE or anyone to be separating families.
Community to Community Development says there is a connection between the arrest and the hours-long detainment of more than 60 Iranian-Americans at the Canadian border earlier this year, noting both took place in Whatcom County and under Customs and Border Patrol's watch. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A Washington state bill would require every school district to teach comprehensive sexual education to students ranging from kindergarten to grade 12. SB 5395 was passed Wednesday by the Washington State Senate, establishing science-based, age-appropriate sexual health education as required curriculum. Under the proposal, parents have the right to exclude their children from the program. Senator Claire Wilson, a Democrat from Auburn, introduced the bill as a means to establish a statewide standard confronting sex ed. In a press statement on Wednesday, Wilson said, "This is about medical and economic consequences and choices, and how to make great decisions for your health and future." In Battleground, the district recently approved sex ed as an elective, meaning if parents wanted their kids to learn sex ed, they would have to opt in. Local resistance to the bill claims local control is more effective regarding the issue, as the proposed one-size-fits-all mentality is not realistic. SB 5395 will now move on to the House for approval.
A bill to end solitary confinement for young people in Washington state jails and detention facilities is making its way through the state legislature. Studies have found that solitary confinement can have detrimental effects on the developing brains of young people. Eric Tegedoff has this story.
The practice has come under increased scrutiny across the country, including the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry's assessment that it can lead to depression, anxiety, and even psychosis. The legislation comes at the request of the Attorney General, and its prime sponsor in the House is Representative Strom Peterson.
For decades, it was thought that this would be a good way to calm somebody down or get somebody to change their behavior, when in fact, that kind of isolation creates such anxiety and such psychological trauma that they're often more violent or more reactive when they come out instead of less.
Bans or limits on youth solitary confinement have passed in red and blue states across the country, including California and Texas. Last week, the Human Services and Early Learning Committee recommended the House pass the bill. Peterson says there's broad support for the legislation, including from people in law enforcement.
People want to make sure that our young people are taken care of, so when they re-enter society, that they're re-entering as healthy and productive human beings, and that we're also, in the short term, protecting the staff that are working at these juvenile facilities.
Peterson says he would also like to address solitary confinement of adults in prison. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Oregon Secretary of State candidate Jamie McLeod Skinner. At 6, it is Labor Radio. At 6:30, it is Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with possible high wind gusts and a low of 47. Tomorrow's weather, rainy once again with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1880, Thomas Edison received a patent for the incandescent lamp, or what we would now call the light bulb. The quote of the day is from Edison, who said, quote, "Many of life's failures are people who did not realize just how close they were to success when they gave up."
The trial of Donald Trump continued for the seventh day in the U.S. Senate. Today was the second day of opening arguments by Trump's defense lawyers. The hearing came in the midst of reports that a transcript of a book by former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton has been leaked. The transcript reportedly confirms that Trump personally demanded the quid pro quo with Ukraine that is at the center of his impeachment. Meanwhile, in the Senate itself, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has stated that he will not allow witnesses, evidence, or subpoenas, leading many Democrats to call the trial a sham and a cover-up. Here's Senator Chuck Schumer speaking to reporters during a recess in today's trial hearing.
House Democrats subpoenas tried to shut out
a... Whoever heard of a court proceeding without witnesses and documents? Whoever heard of a trial without witnesses and documents? If we are a court, all the more reason we have to hear the evidence. Second, Mr. Sekulow said when he listed his 5 points, not a single witness said they heard from POTUS himself. We want Bolton. We want Mulvaney. They heard from the president himself. We can solve Mr. Sekulow's problem of not having witnesses who heard from the president himself by having Bolton, by having Mulvaney, by having Blair, and by having Duffy and the documents underneath underneath what they said. Third, the idea that the House can do oversight, which is also what Mr. Starr said, that's their way to keep a president in line. As you have heard, no president has ever blocked oversight, has blocked any kinds of congressional inquiries more than this president. And finally, if the founding fathers said you would have wait for elections unless a crime is committed, they wouldn't have listed high crimes and misdemeanors. In fact, every constitutional expert, including those at the time like Mason, including Hamilton, including all of the experts who have followed up, have said you don't need a crime to unseat the president for high crimes and misdemeanors. So I don't think they made a very strong case at all. They continue to avoid the facts. Let us hear from, I'd like Mr. Perpera, when he's mentioning the president's document, you don't hear the word Biden, you don't hear the word CrowdStrike. Those are in the document. Why? It's obvious. It's obvious. Because the president was asking for a quid pro quo. The bottom line is very simple. If the president does something that is an abuse of power, and if the president then stonewalls Congress into investigating it, then impeachment is the only remedy left to Congress other than elections. And in this case, since it involves trying to jaundice our elections, trying to distort our elections, elections is not the remedy.
White House lawyer Patrick Philbin claimed in his testimony that during the House impeachment inquiry, the House banned White House counsel from participating.
House Democrats subpoenas tried to shut out executive branch counsel, agency counsel, from the depositions of executive branch employees. Now, the Office of Legal Counsel concluded the congressional committees may not bar agency counsel from assisting an executive branch witness without contravening the legitimate prerogatives of the executive branch.
But this contradicts a December 6th statement by White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who rejected an invitation to take part in impeachment hearings before the House Judiciary Committee. The White House lawyers had been asked to participate, but had simply refused.
According to a new report, the Affordable Care Act has reduced racial and ethnic disparities in access to health care, but that progress has now stalled. Andrea Sears has more.
The uninsured rate for African Americans dropped by 10 percentage points to 14.4%, and the rate for Hispanic adults fell from more than 40% to 25%. According to Sarah Collins with the Commonwealth Fund, the ACA also significantly reduced the gaps in health care coverage between white Americans and people of color, especially in states that expanded Medicaid.
The racial gap narrowed so much that Black Americans, on average, who are living in those states are now more likely to be insured than white Americans living in states that did not expand Medicaid.
She cautions that since 2016, that progress has stalled and some ground has been lost, but she says there are simple steps Congress and states can take to spur more improvements. Collins points out that the stall is due in part to large states such as Texas and Florida that still haven't expanded Medicaid, and cost is still a factor.
There are some ongoing affordability issues buying health plans through the marketplaces for people who are just over the income threshold that makes them eligible for tax credits or a subsidy to buy insurance.
She says actions by the Trump administration to limit enrollment in marketplace plans also have had an impact. Collins says if the remaining 14 states refuse to expand Medicaid, the federal government could help people in those states who would qualify to buy plans through the marketplace and take steps to make premiums more affordable.
Allowing people whose incomes are just over $100,000 a year for a family of four who right now have to pay the full premium to be eligible for a subsidy really wouldn't cost that much for the federal government to make that kind of change.
The report also recommends allowing undocumented immigrants to buy health insurance through the marketplace. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
When it comes to the race for the Democratic nominee for president, polls are back and forth, but frontrunners are emerging. However, many Iowa voters are still undecided, so anything could happen. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
From 2013 to 2018, the uninsured rate for African Americans dropped by 10 percentage points to 14.4%, and the rate for Hispanic adults fell from more than 40% to 25%. According to Sarah Collins with the Commonwealth Fund, the ACA also significantly reduced the gaps in health care coverage between white Americans and people of color, especially in states that expanded Medicaid.
The racial gap narrowed so much that Black Americans, on average, who are living in those states are now more likely to be insured than white Americans living in states that did not expand Medicaid.
She cautions that since 2016, that progress has stalled and some ground has been lost, but she says there are simple steps Congress and states can take to spur more improvements. Collins points out that the stall is due in part to large states such as Texas and Florida that still haven't expanded Medicaid, and cost is still a factor.
There are some ongoing affordability issues buying health plans through the marketplaces for people who are just over the income threshold that makes them eligible for tax credits or a subsidy to buy insurance.
She says actions by the Trump administration to limit enrollment in marketplace plans also have had an impact. Collins says if the remaining 14 states refuse to expand Medicaid, the federal government could help people in those states who would qualify to buy plans through the marketplace and take steps to make premiums more affordable.
Allowing people whose incomes are just over $100,000 a year for a family of four who right now have to pay the full premium to be eligible for a subsidy really wouldn't cost that much for the federal government to make that kind of change.
The report also recommends allowing undocumented immigrants to buy health insurance through the marketplace. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
New Jersey Governor Philip Murphy announced that the state will now require builders to take into account the impact of climate change in order to win government approval for projects. Governor Murphy, a Democrat, is joining many other officials in using state laws to address worsening climate conditions and to counteract the Trump administration's push to roll back environmental regulations. New Jersey's initiative is believed to be the broadest and most specific attempt to leverage land use rules to control where and what developers can build. Through an executive order, Governor Murphy will require the state's Department of Environmental Protection to begin drafting new regulations to be adopted by January of 2022. While the rule changes would not require legislative approval, they could face legal and political challenges. Once adopted, the rules would add another layer of oversight. They would force applicants to factor in how climate change is expected to impact the project, as well as the effect of its emissions on global warming. The rules would also apply to the construction of state-funded projects and anything built with grants that pass through the Department of Environmental Protection. A recent study, by the way, found that the sea level in New Jersey was rising more than 2 times faster than the global average. It's expected to rise by as much as another foot by 2030.
East Africa is facing its worst locust swarm in decades. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization said that Ethiopia and Somalia have not seen an infestation this bad in 25 years, while Kenya is facing its largest swarm in 70 years. The UN humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, said, quote, "Vulnerable families that were already dealing with food shortages now face the prospect of watching as their crops are destroyed before their eyes." The locust swarm was exacerbated by heavy rains that occurred late last year. The UN had been warning that the locust infestation could spread since November. Some farmers in Ethiopia's Amhara region lost 100% of their crops. An intense swarm even forced an Ethiopian passenger plane off course in December. Locusts can travel up to 93 miles per day, and each adult can eat its weight in food in the same time span. Just a small swarm of locusts can eat enough food to feed 35,000 people in only 24 hours. In Kenya, the locusts have infested more than 170,000 acres of land. The unusually large size of the swarms has been linked to the climate crisis. Heavy rainfall and warmer temperatures are perfect conditions for locust breeding. Even more rain that is expected this spring could cause the locust swarms to grow by a factor of 500 before drier weather is expected in June.
U.S. authorities have now confirmed 5 cases of coronavirus, all among people who previously traveled to Wuhan province in China. 2 new cases were reported on Sunday, one in Los Angeles County, California, and the other in Maricopa County, Arizona. The 3 previously reported cases were in Orange County, California, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington State. According to public health officials, the virus can cause fever, coughing, wheezing, and pneumonia. It is a member of the coronavirus family that is closely related to the deadly SARS and MERS viruses that have caused outbreaks in the past. In China, dozens of people have already died from that virus. In response, the country has issued massive travel bans in hard-hit areas of the country to try and prevent the spread of the virus. The U.S. consulate in Wuhan province announced on Sunday that it would evacuate its personnel and some other private citizens from the region. It's believed that the virus has an incubation period of about 2 weeks. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expects that many more Americans will be diagnosed with the newly discovered virus. The worldwide number of confirmed cases has almost reached 2,000. The CDC is screening passengers on direct and connecting flights from Wuhan at 5 major airports. Officials noted that more than 2 dozen people who had been infected with, who have been suspected of having the illness ended up testing negative. The CDC has said that people who have had casual contact with patients are at, quote, minimal risk for developing the virus.
On Saturday, the National Weather Service issued a warning for the possibility of sneaker waves along the Oregon and Washington coast through Sunday evening. Sneaker waves are waves that can happen unexpectedly and with significant force, and sometimes reach areas near the beach that are away from normal tidal zones. They often accompany stormy weather and can surge with enough power to lift logs and knock people off their feet. Sneaker waves happen most frequently between November and March, accompanying winter storms that cause the ocean to become more violent. The Weather Service warns that these waves may create life-threatening conditions in the surf zone. They advise using caution when near the water and to keep a close watch on children and pets.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has laid out a recovery plan for the endangered rusty-patched bumblebee. Mike Moen has the story.
A certain kind of bumblebee that once thrived in the Midwest and along the East Coast is now endangered, and federal officials are moving forward with plans to reverse the population decline of the rusty-patched bumblebee. The insect was added to the federal endangered species list in 2017. Experts say the bee's population has been wiped out by nearly 90%, and it's only present in about a dozen states, including Wisconsin. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced a plan to help this pollinator stage a comeback. Agency spokesperson Georgia Parham says it centers around habitat fixes.
Creating and restoring habitat in areas where the bee now exists and creating habitat in other parts of its historic range.
The agency says exposure to pesticides and a disease-causing pathogen also contributed to the population decline. It's accepting public comments on the recovery plan, which will be used as a guide for conservationists to try and get the rusty-patched bumblebee off the endangered list. The agency was sued by the Natural Resources Defense Council for not moving fast enough, but that case was settled. Parham says the bee has been able to hang on in the Midwestern states because there's still a lot of prairie lands it can use as a habitat. In addition to federal action, she says backyard planters in these areas can also help the bee recover.
People that like to attract pollinators and butterflies, if you're doing that, you're going to create habitat for species like the rusty patch bumblebees.
The chubby-looking bee got its name because of the distinct black and yellow rusted patch that runs along its back. The public comment period for the recovery plan runs through February 24th. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 27th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melissa Hood, Jeffrey Wade, S.J. Oxendine, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Lily Bolke, Mike Moen, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, talking all things politics and history with your call-in comments. At 9, alternative radio featuring lectures and interviews from progressive thinkers. At 10, it is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Mae Roberts talks with pianist and composer David Ornette Cherry for an in-depth look at his music and new collection of compositions. At 11:30, hear Art Focus. Joseph Gallivan interviews Laura Muller, art curator at Portland Japanese Garden, about Spirits Rising, Hiroshima, by photographer Isshuki Miyuko, the first exhibition for the garden's themed Year of Peace. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, and we certainly hope that you will, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today in the studio, we're lucky to be talking with Jamie McLeod Skinner, who's running as a Democrat for Oregon's Secretary of State on the November 2020 ballot. McLeod Skinner ran for Congress for Oregon's 2nd Congressional District in 2018 and set new records for Democratic turnout. This included winning two counties that tend to lean conservative, Deschutes and Hood River. She currently holds both an elected and an appointed office in Oregon. She's an elected board member of the Jefferson County Education Service District and was also appointed by Governor Kate Brown as a board member at large for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, which provides grants to restore and protect watersheds and habitats. Prior to this, she served as a city councilor in Santa Clara, California for 8 years. She has a degree in engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, a master's in regional planning from Cornell, and a law degree with an emphasis in Indian law, environmental law, and water rights from the University of Oregon. She also worked for the International Rescue Committee in post-war Bosnia and Kosovo, rebuilding schools, hospitals, and sanitation systems. And, fun fact, she graduated from Ashland High School, where the record she set in the 800 meters still stands.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much for being here today. So I guess our first question is just, what inspired you to run for Secretary of State?
All my life, I've been committed to good governance. That started back when I was a kid. I actually lived in East Africa as a young child. My mom took a teaching job there, and some of my classmates were refugees from Uganda who had fled Idi Amin. And that early experience, my work in Bosnia and Kosovo, and a belief that we have the best imperfect form of government there is, but it really requires us to step up and get involved and hold it accountable. So I've been committed to good governance. The race for Congress was really to bring accountability to Washington, D.C., and we saw the House flip. And there's some issues here in Oregon that I think we really need to address. And there's some tremendous opportunities through this role as well. But it's important to me to bring folks together to solve the problems we can all agree need to be fixed and that we can take care of that.
I wanted to ask, a lot of people are familiar with what the Secretary of State does on a national level. It's the nation's diplomat and so forth. On a state level, can you describe for us what the Secretary of State position is and why it's important?
Absolutely. And I believe that the Secretary of State is the most important statewide role in Oregon right now with redistricting coming up. But there's so many aspects to the role that people don't really get. You know, a lot of folks realize that there's the oversight to our elections and the election security integrity piece are critical. A lot of folks realize that the Secretary of State oversees our audit process, and we're actually the only Secretary of State in the nation that also oversees audits of state agencies. There's a seat on the state land board, so it's overseeing how we manage our state lands and waterways, and so having an environmental background is really critically important. But also registering businesses, registering corporations and businesses, the role in overseeing our the state archives, and there's opportunities there in terms of telling the state story that could be really unique. There's a role on this on the statewide school board that is important, and the background in education is really important there. A lot of folks realize that it's the essentially the lieutenant governor, though we don't call it that. Only 10 states in the country have the Secretary of State serve as lieutenant governor. And this super important role following the 2020 census, and don't forget to please respond to the census. We need to count everyone. That's really important, little plug. But after the census, every 10 years, every state in the nation redraws its political boundaries. So if you've heard of gerrymandering, mm-hmm. that's when they're drawn very unfairly. So the process here in Oregon is it goes through a state legislature, the governor signs it. If that system breaks down, so if there's a walkout like we saw last session, mm-hmm. then it falls on the Secretary of State's shoulders to draw those political boundaries for the next 10 years. That can shape the politics and the power in our state for the next 10 years. It's incredibly important.
So given that the Secretary of State has so many duties and responsibilities, can you tell us what your priorities would be in that position?
Yeah, absolutely. So making sure our voices are heard, election security and integrity is critically important. Here in Oregon, we have paper ballots. That's a step ahead of a lot of states, but we also, there's still security measures we need to put in place and election integrity, bringing more people into the process. That's one. The second is building up accountability of government and building public trust. That's through the audit process. And then the state lands piece, my environmental background. So working not only now as an attorney, environmental attorney and consultant, but my background in water systems, making sure that we have long-term sustainable vision for our state lands and waterways. I mean, that's, when we're talking about climate change, that's a way we can address it through this office.
So what of those, what do you think would be the biggest problem facing Oregonians? And I know that covers a vast swath of different people from urban to more rural. Is there anything that you would say unites all Oregonians that we're all facing together?
Well, absolutely. All those key points. You know, we all, regardless of your party affiliation, wanting to have our voices to be heard and free and fair elections, that's something we can agree on. Wanting government to be accountable and making sure our taxpayer dollars are well spent, that's something that across the board we can agree on. And when we're looking at audits, I don't look at just, what I'm promoting is not just looking at financial audits. So the, you know, making sure that the dots are, I's are dotted and T's are crossed. I'm also talking about performance audits. So is the money spent as intended? That's been an issue in the state. And equity audits. So we can make sure that we're addressing equity issues through our audit process. Also information security to protect kids and the elderly. But that equity audit process is something that we can really do to sink our teeth into where we're seeing a lot of issues that we really need to address here in Oregon right now.
Let's talk a little bit about your congressional campaign. You know, Oregon is like a lot of states. Your urban areas tend to be more liberal. Your rural areas tend to be more conservative. But you were able to basically bridge that divide. And I want to hear your thoughts about what you thought inspired people from Deschutes and Hood River to vote for a Democrat.
Well, I think what's really important is to realize that we have progressive and real liberal folks in rural areas as well, and just like you have conservative folks in urban areas. But it's really seeing, finding those issues of common interest. And then also sometimes it's just the language we use or kind of these political silos we've gotten into. You know, I had wheat growers in Wasco County. So most folks would hear that and think, ah, conservative Republican talking to me about climate change. Because who, think about it, who is the most impacted by our changing climate? It's folks in the ag community, folks, ranchers, and folks in the forestry industry. So folks who are super concerned about the direction things are going, but we get caught up politically in the shouting match, and then we fail to move forward on legislation. So I found people really hungry for working together to find solutions. We have the opportunity to do that statewide, and that's what people really responded to. I mean, I'm a proud lifelong Democrat, but I can't tell you how many Republicans came up to me and said, I've never voted for a Democrat before, but you're talking about what makes sense, what we need right now. And that's where we need to get back to in politics, I think.
So what do you think is differentiating you from all the other candidates that we'll see on the ballot in November?
Sure. Well, we've got the primary first coming up in May, and that's going to be the first challenge. I think the first piece is just the, you know, I mentioned the Secretary of State's role and how complex it is and the how diverse it is. Well, I actually am the lone candidate who has experience in all the different areas. So I worked for many years with refugee and immigrant communities on things like naturalization, on voter outreach. And so working with diverse communities, bringing people into the process, I've done that work before. I've been in elected office now going on 9 years, so having that experience. But when it comes to government, looking at audits, to understand how government functions, you need to understand there are many different perspectives. There's the frontline staff perspective, there's the management perspective, and there's the policymaker, the lawmaker perspective. I'm the only one who's been in all of those different roles and has that different experience. I'm the only one who's been a union member. I was a union member for over 10 years. And, you know, I have international experience. I've managed multi-million dollar projects. I've managed teams. I've done all those pieces. The environmental background, not only my law background, but also my engineering background on designing systems. I worked as an environmental planner for 5 years. You know, it's a 2 million population, urban and rural. So all of that experience really ties in. But there's also some really creative things we can do. I didn't go into this part of it, but things like on the state archives, it's telling the state story. And there's an opportunity to tell our state story from all the different perspectives of people who've had the different backgrounds that bring their experience to the table and make us who we are as Oregonians. So there's all sorts of creative things we can be doing, as well as hosting town halls around the state and bringing people together to have these tough conversations. So I have that experience. I have a real passion for it. And then also, I would be the only one who has experience throughout the state. So all our other statewide elected officials are from the Portland area, and in the primary, all my colleagues running are all from the Portland metro area. I have urban experience. I worked in Silicon Valley for over 10 years, but also have that rural experience and rural understanding. And I think that understanding is really important to bring to the table. And then one last thing, it's just, again, the outreach. My website, jamiefororegon.com, it's in English and Spanish. We've got translation on there. We're committed to really reaching out and bringing people into the process.
Sound like a Renaissance woman. Really? So Secretary of State position would be a good one for you. Being a member of the LGBTQ community, how has that impacted your campaign?
Well, let me say this. I came out when I was a young adult back in the 80s, and I've had some really painful experiences with homophobia in my life. And keep in mind that back then, things were very different politically. I mean, you know, as a Democrat today, you almost couldn't get elected if you're not supportive of the LGBTQ community.
Right.
Back then, it was just the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen things come a long way. But I have used those experiences to really inform my thinking about how we create a good and safe government. So, for example, I don't know what it's like to be a woman wearing a hijab going into an Islamophobic setting. But I do know what it's like to have someone look at you, someone who knows nothing about you as a person, look at you with absolute hatred in their eyes. And so I take from that experience, you know, my responsibility then as an elected official and as a community leader is to help shape and create an environment where folks don't have that pit in the stomach experience. And so working with other communities, that they're folks that I won't know their own personal experience, but I know the experience of not being respected and being looked down on and not being heard. And we've got folks across our state right now who are not feeling heard. You mentioned the typical assumptions about urban-rural divide. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of Democrats throughout rural areas who are not feeling heard, even by the Democratic majority that's more urban-based. Mm-hmm. So it really cuts across that political spectrum. Being rural is almost more of an identity. It's both a more kind of independent-minded, but also interdependent-minded, because we know we're reliant on our neighbors. So it's more of an identity that's bringing to the table. But it's just one of the many identities that I've experienced, and that knowing that sense of otherness, I think, helps me to relate to others who are in that position themselves. But I used to like to say when I was in the congressional race, because a lot of people in urban areas would ask me about, oh, how is it, you know, being gay and being out lesbian in mm-hmm. Eastern Oregon?
Right.
And I actually would have incredible experiences of conservatives coming up to me and thanking me for being out because they have family members who are gay. But my favorite response to it was to say, look, I'm not afraid of telling people in Eastern Oregon I'm gay. What makes me nervous is telling people in Ashland that I listen to country music.
I was a country music DJ for about 20 years.
Oh, there you go.
Years,
there you go.
So yeah, no, yeah. I know that bias.
You know that, exactly.
I feel your pain.
You see what I'm saying? We yeah. are very, we're complex. Even, you know, as an urban woman, you know that experience.
Right, exactly. So. What I wanted to touch on now is a little bit with your community dispute mediator experience. I've sort of you've touched on it a little bit when you've been talking, and definitely that's experience that you have. How is that going to help you, you know, in the position of Secretary of State?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And it's funny, someone was asking me about that earlier today. I think it's more of a mentality and experience of having a long-term vision of where you want to go. And, you know, we're human beings. Conflict is inherent. But trying to figure out how to help us all work together through our own stuff to hear each other and move together towards that long-term goal. You know, it's not just the formal training and the community, the volunteer community mediation I did for years when I was in the Bay Area. But it was even when I was, you know, I was working in Kosovo and working in mixed villages. And this was post-war, and there was tremendous conflict. We had, you know, I'd go into a school where the two school directors, there would be the Serb director and the Albanian Kosovar director, who had not spoken to each other in years. There would be a brick wall up the middle of the school. And the Serbian government then was in charge, but the majority of the population was Albanian. And so my job was essentially to do a project in that community, in that village, and in that building, was to run shuttle diplomacy between the Serb director and the Kosovar director, and to talk about their needs and concerns and interests, and then share those needs back and forth, have them agree and consensus on what we needed to do and where we need to go forward with that project, then find community volunteers, so building up that trust in the community and getting people to work on those shared projects. And I can't think of an exception to this, but by the end, we'd start with these separate meetings, and by the end, we would be holding joint meetings. And it sounds like a small thing, but it was actually huge. And I was thinking about that the other day, because that's almost what we're doing politically between Republicans and Democrats. It's that mm-hmm. same mentality of getting us to focus on, you know, regardless of party affiliation, we care about our families, we care about our communities. We want to put a roof over our head and food on our table. We want opportunities for our kids. We want health care for our families. I mean, this is all true. So how do we work together on these things? And that's really, I've had some formal training in it, but it's also just the kind of work I've done all my life.
Well, it sounds like you are an expert at being involved in combative situations. So bridging that red and blue is going to be it's going to be definitely something that you'll have to do in this state or anywhere that you would be. Thank you so much for being with us today. We have been speaking with
Jamie McLeod Skinner, who is running for Oregon Secretary of State. The primary is May
May 19th. But your ballots will go out in late April. My website is jamiefororegon.com if you want info. And let me just say this really fun fact that my first time on a radio was back. I was a student DJ of Homo Radio, which is only the fourth LGBTQ radio show in for RPI when I went there. So it takes me back.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it's been a pleasure having you. You're obviously very good at it. So.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for all you're doing for our community. It's really wonderful. So thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you so much.
This has been...
That was KBOO. 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next, Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors will meet Tuesday, January 28th at 6 p.m. instead of Monday for their January board meeting.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Classical Music Confidential on Monday, February 10th, from 11 a.m. to noon at the Central Library Branch at the Multnomah County Library in Portland. Classical Music Confidential will be hosted by Bruce Charles and will take a look at Portland's secret classical music past of the 1940s. Again, that's Classical Music Confidential on Monday, February 10th from 11 a.m. to noon at the Central Library Branch of the Multnomah County Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill and I'm here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey Amanda.
Hey Jamie. Tonight our guest is Suzanne Sutherland, president of the Clark College Association for Higher Education, who just finished a successful 3-day strike on January 13th, 14th, and 15th. Welcome, Suzanne.
Hello.
Woohoo! Successful 3-day strike.